The Energy Utilities and Telecommunication Committee to order, March 8th. Thanks everybody for coming. We have two bills on the agenda. The first one is Senator Chamberlain's Energy Forward Pricing, Senate File 1918. Welcome, Senator Chamberlain, to the Energy Committee, your fresh new face.
Yes, it is. First time here, Madam Chair. Thank you. I do have an amendment. I'm going to do that first.
Senator Brown, would you like to move the A2 amendment?
Madam Chair, I move the A2 amendment.
Senator Chamberlain, would you like to just explain?
Yes.
Amendment does.
The bill as written originally under subdivision 1, item 1, and it had struck out except electricity used in state operations. And that was probably an error due to the regulatory environment and other operational issues. It was neither wise nor practical to strike that. So talking with Xcel Energy, we were happy to accommodate them and put that back in. The only question I have now is the amendment coming around reinstates except electricity, but still leaves used in state operations out. Now, maybe I could ask counsel if that would work all right.
Mr. Fuller.
Madam Chair, Senator, the reason it was retained as stricken is because the ability to use forward pricing was authorized for other than state agencies. So that was seen as modifying that, not the electric part of it.
So it'll still work as is.
It was kept stricken because it would not be accurate.
Okay, I agree. Okay, good. Thanks.
Okay, Senator Brown moves the A2 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. We
do you have a quorum?
I'm sorry.
We don't have a quorum. Senator Chamberlain.
Yeah, Madam Chair, members, I'll briefly describe this, then Mr. Lemunyan and Mr. Bertelson have a brief overview of what we're trying to do here. What we're trying to do here is what this bill does, expands the use of energy forward pricing mechanisms from some state agencies to all government agencies, municipalities, and it's as an optional way to reduce budget risk. It also expands the type of fuel, the amount of energy provided, and establishes an oversight mechanism for these processes. So it adds fuel types adds unleaded fuel to the fuel types, defines government agencies, including state colleges, universities, expands the amount of energy used from 90% to 100% in up to 48 months, and requires each agency using the energy forward pricing to establish an oversight process. Previously, only Hennepin County and the Met Council could do this, so we believe this is will help out these agencies if they want to use it to budget stability and save money, hopefully over time. With that, if I may, I'd turn over to Mr. Lemunyan.
Mr. Lemunyan, welcome. Please state your name for the record.
My name is Jeff Lemunyan, and I am the owner of Linwood Capital, which is an energy price risk management firm based here in the Twin Cities. We create and manage fuel hedging programs primarily for public entities on a nationwide basis. And what I'd like to talk about today is what hedging is, how it works, and how it can benefit public entities. The question is, can fuel costs be controlled? The answer is yes, through forward pricing. And this is really nothing more than establishing the price today for fuel that will be consumed later. The result of forward pricing is a lower fuel budget risk because you would know the costs in advance, a higher certainty of future fuel costs, lower fuel cost volatility, and the fact that the daily market price of fuel is no longer determining the cost and that you have an ability to do that in advance. This works typically through financial instruments, futures on gasoline and diesel fuel. And the reason why it works is because there is a high correlation between the cost that is experienced at the pump and the price of the financial instruments. This graph is a demonstration of the relationship between diesel cost and diesel futures prices. And as you can see, the blue line is the diesel cost experienced by this particular entity, and the pink line is the futures price, very high correlation, making the relationship very effective. And so what this means in a practical sense is that if you were to hedge your fuel supply at $2.50 per gallon and prices go to $3 a gallon, you would pay $3 to the pump. The financial instrument would pay you 50 cents, and your net cost would be $2.50. This shows in a graphic representation what the effects of hedging are. And so you have a forward pricing curve associated with these different commodities. And so there are futures contracts, markets that show what the forward expected prices of gasoline and diesel fuel and natural gas are. And those are directly observable. Those prices are on the internet and observable every day. And so you can see that in both of these graphs, if we look 1 year forward, it's something like $2.25 a gallon. Unfortunately, this is an old graph. The pink and yellow lines show the potential variability or variation in price over a particular period of time. And so the unhedged analysis on the left-hand side shows that if we move a year forward from the start of this graph, that we have $2.25 a gallon, plus or minus about a dollar a gallon. So that indicates the level of budget risk that is being experienced by the various state agencies. On the right-hand side, we have an example of what it would look like if you are 90% hedged. And so you have the same blue line, the same expected costs into the future, but you have a much narrower range of what those costs are going to be. So another way of saying this is that if you expect your costs to be $2.25 a gallon and they go to $3.25 a gallon, if they go up by a dollar, if you're hedged, your net cost will only increase by 10 cents if you're 90% hedged. And so why is this advantageous? Obviously, better planning, budgeting, and forecasting, knowing what the costs are going to be before they happen. A more efficient capital structure, less need for reserves in case of higher fuel costs, and an increase in overall organizational efficiency. So there won't be someone who has to find out how to get the extra money to pay for the fuel and to divert their attention away from that. This will certainly hedging certainly decreases the likelihood of that happening. Especially public entities. There are many types of organizations that do this, airlines and such. It is especially appropriate for public entities. There are no shareholders to absorb higher fuel costs in the form of lower earnings, difficult to pass along to customers, be it on school buses or public transit. And public entities really don't compete with each other, and there are no competitive pressures like there would be in private industry. So this is an example of long-term performance of a hedging program. The blue line here shows us a 10-year historical price range, prices from 2000 to the end of 2010. And you can see the big spike that there was in 2008, and then as prices came back down. That is the pump price for fuel. The pink line shows what the net cost of fuel would be net of the hedge. And so what this is meant to demonstrate here is that there are periods of time when you are where your net cost is more than you're paying at the pump and periods of time when there is less. And that the long-term expectation of a hedging program, if done blindly, would simply be that the realized gains and realized losses would add up to zero, and the benefit that you get along the way is the higher certainty of future costs. And so this is an example.
Hold on,
I'm sorry?
Please, Senator Vandiver, I think you had a question maybe a slide or two back.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, this is just, I don't know if this is appropriate time, but with regard to futures, I know that's different than hedging a little bit if you're just buying futures to invest in, but does is that ever able to be financed by lenders in any way, or do you know of that?
Mr. Lemonian.
Madam Chair, members, I don't, as far as finance, as far as prepaying. I know there are natural gas deals that are done that way.
I guess, Madam Chair, my question is more to get to the point better. If can you finance a futures contract as an individual? Is that something you've seen done, or
Mr. Lemonian?
Madam Chair, typically there are not. This is not financing. It is a futures contract. It is not an asset that is purchased. It is a forward agreement to later buy or sell something. So as far as it needing capital to run, it's not a security or an asset. It is a forward agreement. It's a contract. And so, of course, it does take capital to run these contracts in the form of essentially good faith money that you would deposit with the broker so that they would know that you can absorb losses. But as far as financing it, not as such.
Thank you.
Mr. Lemonnier.
And so in this example, the budget for fuel is $2.60 per gallon. And the during this particular month, the actual cost from the supplier turns out to be $3 per gallon. And in this example, 300,000 gallons are purchased. So the bill to the supplier is $900,000, or from the supplier. But during the preceding months and years, six forward pricing contracts have been accumulated, and they are 42,000 gallons each. And so there are hedged 252,000 gallons of the 300,000 from this month. The average contract buy price is $2.50 per gallon. The average sell price is $3 per gallon because that's the market price. The realized gain is 50 cents per gallon. 50 cents per gallon gain on the 252,000 gallons is a net gain of 126,000. That becomes an element of fuel cost, and so you net those two together, and your net fuel cost is $2.58 per gallon, which is under your budget. In this example, same example, but instead of prices going up 50 cents a gallon, they have gone down. So your budget is still $2.60. You're paying $2 instead of $3 to the supplier, so you paid the supplier $600,000. The hedge contracts result in a 50 cent per gallon loss because of the lower fuel prices, and so you pay the hedge $126,000. Your net fuel cost is $2.42 per gallon. So that's some of the mechanics of how hedging works and why it's beneficial to public entities.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Lemonian? Okay, great. Mr. Bethelson.
Madam Chair, I just have to interject. I forgot to mention at the beginning of the at the beginning here that this idea was brought forward by Mr. Lemonian. I did not dream this up on my own. I wish I had, but Mr. Lemonian brought it forward to Keith County last year. So with that, Mr.
Senator Chamberlain, I actually asked Mr. Fuller why hadn't this come forward before, and so I was kind of surprised that we hadn't worked on this before.
Yeah, well, good ideas are good to have around.
Mr. Senator,
let me ask, it might be a silly question, and I've asked some before. Why do we have to do this? Why can't the different agencies just do it? Does it take legislation? Apparently it does.
Mr. Fuller?
Why don't we do it? I mean, it's a good idea, Senator Chamberlain, but I would think the departments and agencies and others would try to save some money and do it on their own.
Well, yeah, I mean, really.
Why does it take?
Madam Chair, Senator Metzen, I assume they weren't authorized to do it, particularly local units of government. They're institutions of, you know, statutory authority. They can only do what we tell them they can do. And so I assume that's the case. They went through the state government committee, and so they have the expertise. Okay. I assume if they could already do it, they would have known that.
Do you have a handout?
Madam Chair, you'd think that
Senator Metzen
could do it on their own, but apparently not. Thank you.
Mr. Berthelsen, you have a handout. We'll that out for you. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Mike Berthelsen. I'm the Associate Vice President for Facilities Management on the Twin Cities campus of the University of Minnesota. So a couple notes while the handout's coming around. We prepared this when Representative Downey introduced the bill last session, and so we just, for continuity, I guess, left the same material. It hasn't been updated for this last year's, but we could talk about what those changes are. Also, Representative Downey and Senator Chamberlain have just asked the University of Minnesota to come speak on as an example of an institution who has been doing this for some time. So we're not here. We're here to present an example of how it's been done and how we have managed it. So we're here not supporting or opposing the bill, but providing information and our experience. So in short presentation, just to give a sense of the University of Minnesota is about 28 million gross square feet. It has a great variety of facilities and a substantial technology driven, and so certainly use a lot of energy. On slide three, just gives a sense of, for the Twin Cities campus, our projected fuel usage for fiscal 12. You can see it's a substantial amount of fuel that's purchased, almost projected to $14.5 million, the vast majority of that being natural gas. And natural gas has, of these fuels, is the most volatile from a pricing, which it shows up on slide four. You can see the 12-year history of that for us, and it's been as low as $2 per unit to as high of 14, and that's obviously a difficult thing to plan for and to budget for. So that brought us to looking at this activity and putting together that plan. So for our natural gas purchasing strategy, certainly is our goal is to manage risk from a price volatility. How do we manage in a public setting what that price is? And so partly as part of that process as well, we put together a protocol and purchasing plan that has long-term principles and an annual purchasing plan that gives parameters and is reviewed in several stages of review and oversight within the institution. On a routine operating basis, we have a cross-functional team of energy management, finance, and the Office of Investment and Banking, who are more used to the idea of forward pricing, to be responsible for that program. And in addition to that, we also hire market expertise, an external group that provides us counsel and some market insight. You can see on the last slide then what our history has been, and though our price, our primary goal is price certainty and planning. You always try to as well try to beat the market to the extent you can. And you can see over the over this period of time, we averaged about $2.5, almost $3 million of savings relative if we had just bought natural gas on the market versus how we did buy it in the future. I think the current world where natural gas prices have been plummeting, you would see that we haven't been saving on the hedge stuff as much. We still maintain price certainty, which kind of gave us a cap for how much that price would be. But you know, I think the time where you see where you're paying ahead, paying out, is when the gas, when prices, whatever you're buying, is dropping so fast beyond where you have a future purchase. And so that's kind of that environment. So that's just a few comments. I'm certainly glad to answer a question.
Well, Mr. Berthelsen, we had Chris McGill from the National Gas Association a couple of weeks ago. Mm-hmm. For a hearing to talk about the natural gas trends. And so you will be happy to know that they will stay consistent here for a while. There's not going to be the volatility. I mean, you know, let's see what happens. But it's hard to bank on that, but that's what they're projecting.
Right. We're very glad for that.
Any questions? Mr. Jensen.
Madam Chairman, members, and Mr. Berthelsen, when you submit your operating budget to the legislature, do you have a process of showing the savings or reflect the savings in the process?
Good question. Mr. Berthelsen.
Madam Chair, members, as we put together our biennial budgets looking forward, we take into account our planning purposes and this kind of projection. So those kind of savings are already built into the cost structure that we bring forward to you in the biennial budget.
Good question. Okay, any other further questions to Senator Chamberlain or the witnesses?
Move the bill for him, right?
What else? Senator Chamberlain, your wishes for Senate File 19, does it go straight to the floor, or does anybody else ask for it?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Straight to the floor?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Senator Brown?
Oh, Brown.
Move the bill?
Move it.
Yes, Madam Chair, I'll move the bill.
Senator Brown moves that Senate File 1980 be recommended to pass as amended and sent straight to the floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you very much.
Could have moved that bill for your colleague. Did they do this? I think they'd be able to do it.
Good. Okay, members, we have my bill. Senate File 2181, the RDF reform. And I don't think we necessarily need to go through the reasons why this bill is before us. We've been working on it jointly for a very long time, but I think the, you know, to just recap, the OLA report brought out some very glaring pieces of this RDF bill or what we need to do with this fund. And so we've taken that very, very seriously. And we've engaged with a lot of people around in this room and beyond. And the main thing is that we stay true to the clear purpose and criteria. And I think that that has been very insufficient. So I'm very, very concerned that we stay focused on that and that it must be used for electric energy sources. And we need to also have a single process for approving the expenditures. We've gone over that many, many times and always also keep those expenditures in Minnesota. So streamline all expenditures minus the REPI through one competitive bidding process. We take the advisory group very seriously, and then we worked on the public utilities role. I think everybody's had a chance to look at the language and review that. We do have some changes. We have the A6 amendment also that has that needs to be passed out. And before we – that will get passed out. But with that, I think I'll have Mr. Fuller explain what that amendment will do.
At the University of Minnesota, I'll get in here. Medicare.
Yeah. A6.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Madam Chair, members, the A6 amendment does two things. The amendment to page 2, deleting line 24, has to do with the authorized purposes for expenditures from the fund. And it's a tweaking of it. There was concern raised by some people because it's infrastructure that it was too broad and you wouldn't be doing the renewable energy. So this is narrowed to say that the infrastructure is near commercial and demonstration scale electric infrastructure. And I think one of the primary intents is smart grid sort of things. So it's a narrowing of the earlier expansion of the purposes for which the fund could be spent.
Also, they're not excluded.
Okay. And excuse me, Mr. Fuller, that part of it was worked on with by the utility and Fresh Energy and the Isaac Walton League. They did not necessarily come to a full agreement, but hopefully, and if they'd like to testify, I think they are going to testify, that is something that maybe we can continue to work on, but we'd like to get a consensus on that. And they appreciate the tightening of the language.
Madam Chair, the second amendment to page 2, line 32, was simply an oversight. This language was in the draft that was submitted earlier regarding the authorization for expenditures for administrative purposes and a 5% cap. Simply fell through the cracks, and now it's being restored.
Everybody had a chance to take a look at the amendment? Any questions about that?
Nope.
Okay, all those in favor of the A6 amendment, say aye.
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 All those opposed, nay. Amendment is adopted. Thank you. I just, too, want to say, again, that we took all the concerns from the OLA report very seriously, and I think we've crafted a very reasonable proposal here that can move forward.
I was talking
and
about
there has been great concern, great angst about the University of Minnesota IRES dollars going forward, and we appreciate them coming and testifying. We still have a lot of questions about the appropriation of $5 million a year. I must say that they have been talking with utilities, which is great. And we've had many, many conversations and will continue to have those conversations, and I look forward to it. So I believe the work for the U of M is not done in this bill. I hope not anyway. But we do need to tighten up this process of how we approve these RDF grants. It's very, very important to show some accountability. And the University of Minnesota in the past has come to the advisory group, the board, and had their proposals granted dollars. But then we got into this, the legislature granting the $5 million per year, which we just feel like is not appropriate a way to run this fund. So we're still, like I said, still working on trying to figure out how we're going to address either R&D dollars, which I feel strongly we should invest in the realms of what this fund was developed for, but also still have that accountability measure back to the dollars and back to the ratepayers and make it a streamlined process. So I'm hoping that the university views this bill passing as not necessarily taking their money away, because frankly, if this bill does not pass, their money is gone. And that's the reality. So I look forward to these continued discussions. With that, we have some people that would like to testify. Dick Hemmingson, Managing Director from the IRE. Dick, welcome.
Thank you. Excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Again, I'm Dick Hemmingson, the Managing Director of IRE. I won't repeat a lot of things we said previously, just four brief points, if I might, Madam Chair. We do remain concerned about how innovative research and development will be supported and managed under the current provisions of the bill. And as we expressed to the in response to the Legislative Auditor's Report back in 2010, we believe that narrowing the focus of the state's Renewable Energy Development Fund to renewable electric technology should be carefully considered, especially as it relates to research and development. This narrow focus would not allow, for example, research in areas of significant importance to Minnesota, things like transportation fuels, where 30% of our state's energy is consumed, or carbon sequestration, an issue of concern, I think, to all of us, or, for example, our work on conservation and energy efficiency. So those are some areas that would seemingly be limited under this narrowing definition of renewable electric technologies. I mentioned this briefly at my last appearance, but IRE's matching grant program has been responsible for leveraging nearly 50 of the $70 million in external research support that has been brought into the state. And there's $26 million additional leveraged funds awaiting review by the funding entity. And this bill, as drafted, I think, would simply not allow for the nimbleness that would be needed to respond to those kind of funding opportunities. And so that remains a concern. And finally, Madam Chair, we do look forward to continuing to work with you and other interested parties as this bill moves forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Hemmingson, any questions? Mr. Hemmingson, the only thing I'd like to say is that, once again, I just heard the same thing, is that you need to give us our money, and we want to continue with the projects that we deem fit. And I'm going to go back to, we have to have a structure here. We have to have some accountability. We owe that to the XL ratepayers. So if you can work with us on that, I'd appreciate it. Otherwise, we need to know exactly where all this money goes. And you talk about leveraging and all these other programs. I love transportation fuels. I live in the heart of transportation fuels. But is that fit in this fund? That's the question. And perhaps it's not me that should answer that, but it's the advisory group. It's the people that go back to the PUC, that go back to the utility, that will say, that's a good project. So I'm just saying that we have to figure out how to fit R&D into the structure of these recommendations going forward. I think that's the most responsible, prudent way to address this. Mr. Hemmingson, any?
Again, as I said, we do look forward to continuing to work with you to address the issues that the auditor raised with respect to accountability reporting, and we'll continue to work on that with you and others.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Mr. Grant, Director. Director Grant. Hi, Director Grant.
Madam Chair, committee members, Bill Grant for the Department of Commerce. And thank you for the opportunity to address you briefly on Senate File 2181. Wanted to start by expressing our appreciation between the draft that we'd seen at the last meeting and the bill that was introduced. We really appreciate the restoration of language addressing XL's obligation to the fund after plant operations cease, but before nuclear waste is removed from the state. I know that's something that you and Senator Koch are working on, and I think that's a good step. But that was an important change. I wanted to touch on three other areas, and, Madam Chair, you've mentioned a couple of them. One is the electric infrastructure efficiency language, and you know, we've seen the amended language, and I would agree that we are moving closer. I still believe that in this form, the language is too open-ended, too broad, and I'm concerned not so much for the purposes that Xcel has mentioned that this money could go to and through this language. I'm concerned that it opens the door to all other sorts of possibilities. And I think to be responsive, again, as you're making a very good faith effort to be to the legislative auditor's recommendations in this area, that we really need to be fairly tightly constrained about the purposes for the fund. And I'm concerned that this language, while it moves us closer, is not there yet. So I appreciate the your statements, Madam Chair, that we'll, that this is something that we need to continue working on. The second area relates to the advisory group itself. And our concern is that the language at line 2.36 that mentions simply the company's ratepayers, again, is overly broad and open to interpretation. And we would prefer to see at least those existing slots on the advisory group specifically named within the bill. And those include the Prairie Island Indian Community, the environmental NGO, the business rep, and the Department of Commerce representing all ratepayers. So I'm hoping that that's something that we can address as the bill moves forward. Again, I think that addresses the second area of concern from the legislative auditor's perspective, and that has to do with the governance of the fund and being clear about who's where the roles are and who's involved at each step. And finally, Madam Chair, I'd simply say with respect to research and development that we hope that through continued discussions we can find a reasonable solution to that, to the process for identifying R&D expenditures and the role of the various research entities within the state that might be involved in those projects. So look forward to those conversations, and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Director Grant. And I think that you bring up several good points, that the R&D is important not only to IRE, the University of Minnesota, but other projects that would come into some in my area. That would come. So I am committed to trying to figure that out going forward. The other thing, we've had this discussion with about the advisory group, yes. And I would like to have the utility come up, Mr. Evans, if you would, just in response to that, because there is concern, and we can still continue to work on this. I think this is probably going to go to finance. So, Mr. Evans, welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Rick Evans with Xcel Energy. The concern that we have with well, let me start by saying, you know, we've had the advisory group since nearly the outset of the fund. The advisory group is established by commission orders, and we don't see anything in this bill that would make those orders go away. I think all of the people who've participated over the years in the advisory group, you know, have found it to be an open and fair process, and that everybody's heard, and that to the greatest extent possible, they try to operate by consensus, and that there's a lot of input. The concern that we expressed about starting into the statute and putting more and more parameters around the advisory group is that we do still feel that this is a private fund, albeit directed by the state, which as a regulated utility, we understand, but that as we start to put more and more parameters around this advisory group, it starts to look more and more like some sort of a state board. As you start listing the people who will be represented, you know, as with the attempts for the legislature to take money out of the fund, there's always the next person and the next person and the next person who think they should be represented. You know, we want to have an open and honest process to that decides these issues, but there's just the concern that once we start down the road of putting more parameters, and then we put duties, and then we put responsibilities, and pretty soon you've got a state board, and that's our concern. So our preference would certainly be that we try to not be so directive. Take the last 10 years of, you know, very good efforts on everybody's part to make this work, you know, for some face value. You know, I think everybody's felt like it's been a good process. But, you know, having said that, of course, perhaps there's ways we can sit down and accommodate, you know, whatever concerns people have. But for us, primarily, we're just very concerned about starting down the road of fixing this as some kind of a state committee, and then leading this money into being more like state money, and then we get down the road to where it's no longer a grant-making proposition. So maybe it's just camel's nose under the tent sort of thing, but that's our feeling.
And Mr. Evans, you feel that the representatives on the advisory group, not the board, and so we put it group so you didn't have to go to GovOps there, is representative of the ratepayers. Would you say that?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we feel like that the group we worked with is a good group. The PUC, you know, through their orders, has put the group together and recognized the interests that need to be represented there. I guess I'm not an expert in PUC procedure, but if there's another group that needs to be represented, another interest that's not represented, I imagine that there's a process to do that. Hopefully it doesn't require a change in state law. It would just require, you know, groups working cooperatively together. But our feeling is certainly that the group has worked very, very well, and in, if not 100%, you know, very close to 100% of the cases has operated by consensus on the projects that go forward.
I'll be honest, I was one that, with Director Grant, that thought it had to be spelled out. But after talking with you, Mr. Evans, in my office on this, I understand how, since it is a private fund, to have it spelled out. I truly get that. And Mr. Fuller, do you have something that you want to say?
Well, Madam Chair, I think in the 4 or 5 years we're going to have a very active process, because there's going to be about $30 million every year. So the thought was, the less formalistic we made it, the more nimble they could be. The PUC could, in fact, do what it had been doing. And insofar as not inconsistent with what we say in the bill, they could continue doing that. And that was why we didn't go, even though the auditor was talking about more formal structure, compensation members, that just seemed to get in the way of what's going to be an incredibly busy process if they have a cycle of proposals every year with tens and tens of proposals coming in. So that was the philosophy that drove sort of the advisory group light, because they wanted to be nimble, be able to respond to who they needed, when they needed them, you know, people dropping off and going on. And so I think it's going to be a different environment. They have not had funds of the magnitude they will have because they've been appropriated by the legislature. So there are going to be a substantial number of projects they're going to have to look at.
Senator Cook.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, and it struck me that, you know, this comes about because of the legislative auditor's report. And a portion of that report was, it seemed that this fund was starting to get sort of picked at and spent in different directions. So we're trying to bring it back to its original, more of its original attention. And I caught myself I appreciate you saying, Madam Chair, that you had originally thought it should be more prescribed as well. As Director Grant was speaking and he was listing who he thought should be included in the membership, I was like, well, no, that doesn't really, I think I would add this. I started thinking of members that I would add in my own head. I kind of caught myself. And I tend to agree. I think if we allow it, if it's working, And it has been apparently for a decade, and I don't hear a lot of I don't hear any complaints about it. Why not allow the group to be? I think Mr. Fuller used the word nimble. You know, if it's working, let's and it is a private fund. Why get us involved in that? It seems to me that it allows for more flexibility and perhaps better work if we take a bit more of a hands-off approach. I caught myself starting to think about, and disagreeing with Director Grant on maybe the membership. I thought, no, butt out. Just stay out of it. If it's working and they've got the groups represented, leave it alone.
Yeah. Senator House has some people he wants on an advisory group, too. Yes, Senator House.
Absolutely. You know, but I think we – Madam Chair.
I'm Senator House.
I do think that the rules have changed here. I do think the idea behind this is maybe the same, but realistically, we shouldn't even be having this fund right now. This waste should be gone, and we're heading in the opposite direction on it. So, I think for a short term fund, being flexible and being loose-knit, I think that's great. But now we're looking at something substantially different than what these host communities and what the state of Minnesota and what the past legislators thought they were getting into. So I've got concerns. I've even got concerns when we talk about because I think when this was designed, again, we were thinking real short term. We're talking temporary storage. And we're 12, 14 years past where we thought we'd be. And even some of the language in here says, we're going to stop contributing to this fund once electric generation is gone and the utility companies haven't shown good faith in trying to get it removed. Well, we all know we've been working in good faith on it. We all know the utility companies are working in good faith. Really, I mean, they've actually sued the Department of Energy for breach of contract. So, I mean, some of the damages, I think, that can be claimed under a breach of contract might be removed by some of the statute once electric generation ends. So, I do think that that this has changed so significantly. And now the General Accounting Office is saying, look at interim storage or the possibility for up to 500 years. We're no longer just talking about 8 years here or a decade here. We're talking about centuries. So I think we might have to have an eye towards something a little better structure, significantly longer term than short term. And I'll just leave those comments at that.
Is that, though, Senator Howell, something that can be addressed in the future? Maybe a year or two down the road and perhaps be flexible enough with this as the language is to make sure that the representatives of the ratepayers are on the group and that we are we're addressing their – we're being responsible that way and representing them.
Madam Chair, I think it's something certainly we can look at it down the road a few years. I just don't want it to be, we've already dealt with that a year ago or we already dealt with that 5 years ago and we're going to leave it because we are considering it now. And we all know that, even the testimony we heard that we're years away. Yucca Mountain isn't even the Blue Ribbon Commission that the president had isn't very supportive of a national repository somewhere in the near future. So, I would just want us to consider that when we're making these decisions.
Mr. Evans, any comments?
Well, I guess I just would go back to say this is a very unusual fund. We all recognize that. If the purpose of the fund is to tax money from the utility based on its spent fuel and used as state revenue to do state purposes, the legislature is certainly capable and free to do that. This was set up as something different, and I take Senator Howe's comments to heart. I understand what he's saying, and I understand his concerns, and we share a lot of them. But as terms this fund, I just would like to see the fund be able to go forward in the way it was designed to do the things it was supposed to do. It's a very unique fund in that respect. And our feeling is we'd like to have the freedom and the money to actually do what the fund was set up to do. And it's different from state money to serve state needs, whether they arise because of the nuclear plants or the spent fuel or for other purposes.
And Mr. Fuller did remind me of the reports that need to be, the final reports that need to be given. It's page 3, line 24, talking about a clear written summary for, the report must include an evaluation of the project's financial, environmental, and other benefits to the state and public utilities ratepayers. And then, of course, you have to do one online, which is new. And that was an OLA report. So I think we've built a much stronger structure in the reporting part side of it, which I think is extremely important, more so than the front end. The back end on the accountability measures going forward, I think, is really important. But if, you know, my hope is, Mr. Evans and Director Grant, that you'll continue to talk. Hopefully we can come to some agreement. There is, you know, I don't think this is not a deal breaker, not at all. So, but I do want people to be at least comfortable. Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'm sorry.
And I apologize, we had committees overlapping because of the lateness of the session, so I've returned to committee here. Is this an agreement that people are living with then, or is this some language that people are comfortable with, that this is going to take us forward in a good way? Have most people said that, or have I missed?
Senator McGuire, yes, we did talk quite a bit. We actually had a bill before this, so you didn't miss too much. And my comments were, there were some changes. There was A6 amendment that was negotiated on. And the most controversial part of this whole thing is the IRES dollars. Okay. And I agreed that we will continue to work. We want to make sure that we do support R&D, but it has to fit within the structure of this fund, which is very, very important. So fully continuing those conversations with the utility and the University of Minnesota moving forward to get to some agreement.
So, Madam Chair, then just to clarify, so in this bill, IRE would stay doing what they're doing then, or do you take them? What does this bill do to IRE? Or
If this bill does not pass, Senator McGuire, they get $0.
Okay.
There's no more in 2012. This bill would make them go to the advisory board, and perhaps there can be an agreement that there is some structure for R&D. And the University of Minnesota has gone to the advisory group before they started receiving this $5 million per year, and they have had their projects funded. So we just want to bring it back to some accountability measure and to a structure that is responsible to the utilities, gives the responsibility back to the PUC and to the ratepayers. And I think that's very doable for IRE. They can do that.
And so, Madam Chair, thank you for my indulging me. Thank you. If I remember correctly, was there a percentage that we were giving to IRE, and now we're not, or there was never that?
The bill last year froze the fund, but then we allowed 2011. They did get their $5 million. In 2012, there was no more dollars. So we're asking that that the projects come to the advisory group, and there is participation with the PUC and the advisory group and the utility on this R&D movement and some accountability. And I think, as I mentioned, the report, the evaluation of the project's financial, environmental, and other benefits to the state and the public utilities ratepayers, it's a very responsible way of looking at it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that you are aware of the good work that I read does do, and I'm, you know, hopeful and confident that they're going to be able to continue the good work that they do within this bill. So I'm hoping.
Well, that is my goal, Senator McGuire, and I feel that we can reach that point because I do believe they do some good work, but we have to make sure that it goes to the direction of this fund and how it was developed in the first place, and that's electric generation. Senator Brown, then Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Evans, do you see anything in the language of this bill that would impede the ability of a school district to apply and receive RDF funds for solar projects?
Madam Chair, Senator Brown, no, I don't.
Thank you.
I think there will be some applications for that. You know how I feel about that, Mr. Evans. I was trying to get that into this bill.
If I'm not mistaken, I believe there are some that are currently in the queue. They just haven't been granted because we haven't had any money to grant to make grants with.
Okay. Super. Senator Dipple.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I'm also, I apologize as well. I'm kind of running to catch up here. Not too much going on. Back to the IRE question, though. So as I understand from what I've been able to read in the bill proposal here, as well as if I'm reading the right one.
It's, Senator Dibble, it's the same bill. There's just a few technical changes. The one change you should be aware of, though, is page 2, delete line 24, in a certain year, commercial and demonstration scale electric infrastructure delivery projects. So that does benefit, goes back to the ratepayers. So that was a big project. The A6 amendment, we did adopt that.
Right. Great. Thanks. So the short version of how IRE would receive funds is they would just bring individual proposals over, just like everyone else. There'd be no funds set aside for them to administer within IRE. in the way that they have to, in the way that they do today, they wouldn't have the small funds that they could deploy. To do the matching, go through the peer review, the process that they described in their testimony.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't exist in this proposal.
That does not exist in this proposal. What they would need to do is to as they probably have in the past when they received advisory group approval, is take, and I can envision it being one proposal or a block of proposals, but it must go through the proper channels because this can be negotiated still. I left it open for negotiations, a block of dollars or something that can be, that you can vie for, but it cannot be IRE just gets this amount of money. Then what happens to IRE? What happens to all these other programs out there? So if it's R&D, then you have to prove that this project does fit within the realms of electric generation and sell your project. You just don't have a carte blanche expenditure. If it goes down that direction, then I would request, what are the salaries? What are your expenses? How much did you spend? And we have not asked that question. So I think this is a very fair way of saying the conversations will continue. But you need to figure out how to make this work with an advisor group and the structure that is in place with respect to the utilities and the ratepayers. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think the points you make are good ones, that IRE absolutely should be transparent and accountable and resources they receive from the RDF should be consistent with the vision for the RDF when it was first established. However, I think this proposal doesn't allow IRE to do the kind of R&D to the scale and with the amount of flexibility and through the process by which they do research at this level, at this university research level. I think it simply doesn't allow them to deploy the smaller sums in a more nimble fashion to then leverage the kind of dollars that they're able to leverage into the university. I know that there has been a hybrid proposal, to facilitate all of the criteria that you described, which are good ones. But this proposal, as it is, and I'm glad to hear that you're open to more discussion, I think would hamper IRE in such a way that we're simply making a choice here today that we're not going to be dedicating resources to. And it's not like IRE or the University of Minnesota is some, alien force over here that's, they are our major research institution in the state of Minnesota, particularly on renewable energy research. I feel like, in my view, we should be, climbing all over each other to give them as many resources to do this sort of thing, because that is the economic engine of our state and setting up the services and the products and the ideas for our emerging high-tech renewable energy economy. So, I sometimes detect, not necessarily in your voice, but in other voices and witnesses at the table, some sort of a discouraging tone when it comes to the university is somehow being greedy and asking for too much and doing the wrong thing. They're doing the right thing. and we should affirm that and figure out a way to get to the issues of accountability and consistency with the original mission of the RDF and still give these resources into the hands of where they absolutely need to be. These are amazing people doing amazing things at the University of Minnesota. It's not a bad thing, to, you know, and this is a good source of money to do that. So I haven't really understood why all the friction and all the conflict over how we're going to solve this IREE problem.
Well, Senator Dibble, and I think you bring up some good points. These are good things they are doing, absolutely good things. And if they are good things, then they should be able to stand on their own two legs, on their merits, in front of an advisory group. I think that's mandatory, that there is some accountability. You know, whether they're early stage or late stage, we've talked about that a little bit. If do we want to invest in late stage or do we want to promote? I mean, we are interested in R&D, and I think that's a strong point of this also. But the accountability measure is what I want to still get back to. It's $5 million that, no, that's not their total budget. And, yes, they can leverage off other dollars from it, but we need to bring this $5 million back to say, okay, this is what we got back to not only the ratepayers but to the state. And I think those are really valid questions, and open it up to other institutions that are working on R&D like that. So, like I said, they're continuing to talk. It's taken a while, I'll be honest, for the University of Minnesota to come to this point. The amendment that they did draw up, I was frankly disappointed with, because it basically said that all the R&D goes to them and they get to fund it out to other institutions, and then the advisory group has no say in whether they like the projects or not. Now, that's not quite what I was thinking about with this bill. There's got to be an accountability measure. This is still a private fund, and let's make sure that we secure this accountability measure. Senator Bergwein.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate all of this discussion. I am concerned because I know that IREE does do a lot of matching grants, and I'm just concerned about the timeline. If they have a matching, if they want to apply, you know, for any matching grants that are out there, then would they have to come to the fund? And what if the fund isn't giving out grants then, if they don't have their own money? I'm just worried about if they don't have some flexibility within their own funds to go for matching grants or, you know, offer them. So I'm wondering if you could.
Actually, I think it's a very good idea for us to ask the University of Minnesota to get organized as far as what their projects are. Start looking at priorities. Perhaps they say, oh, maybe this isn't a good idea because it doesn't fit within those realms or those that definition of electric generation. We've even expanded that. We are working on that very thing, though, Senator McGuire, is what happens to him later on. But I will tell you, again, if this bill does not get passed and signed, there is $0 to the U. So I have every intent of making this work for them. But I have to have a willing partner. And up to this point, it has been a little difficult, I will tell you that. And you just probably just missed the lecture I gave Mr. Hemmingson. So I'm not going to do it again. Any other further questions? Thank you, Director Grant. And Ms. Linda Taylor. Ms. Taylor.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Linda Taylor. I am the Clean Energy and Energy Efficiency Program Director at Fresh Energy. I'm here today to testify on behalf of Fresh Energy and the Isaac Walton League of America together. We don't have a lot to say. First, we want to say thank you. This bill really has been heading in the right direction from the very beginning. We think that the improvements that were made in the bill from the first draft that we saw to the introduced draft were fine. We're very happy to see the direction that the bill's going. We're happy to see your dedication to this issue and how you've been managing this going along. As you know, and you had mentioned it at the beginning, of today's hearing that Fresh Energy and the Isaac Walton League have been negotiating with Xcel Energy over the utility infrastructure efficiency language. After a week and a half or so of back and forth, we have decided to agree to disagree going forward. And so it's just important to us that you understand where we're coming from on this. I have submitted some written testimony. I'm certainly not going to read that. But I would like to say that we are committed to renewable electricity generation projects. And that's where we would like to see this go. We understand the internal incentive for Xcel Energy as a company to look beyond that and beyond the infrastructure that would support renewable projects to other interesting and innovative electricity distribution or electricity delivery projects. But we think that the point of this fund was renewable electricity. So we would like to see that limitation. And so we would suggest on the A6 amendment, one simple way to deal with this would be on the A6 amendment, line one, before electric, where it says near commercial and demonstration scale electric, to insert the word renewable. That would pretty much take care of our concerns. And we think this is tighter language than what is in the bill now. And so we think it is heading in the right direction. But we certainly would like to continue to have this discussion going forward to see if we could, in fact, limit this to renewable. And that's important to us.
So, Ms. Taylor, are you saying it would say renewable near commercial and demonstration scale electric infrastructure delivery projects?
It would be near commercial and demonstration scale renewable electric infrastructure delivery projects.
Mr. Fuller.
Last one question, Madam Chair. Ms. Taylor. Are there delivery systems that just deliver renewable energy? I mean, doesn't a delivery system sort of accommodate all sorts of electricity? So could you elaborate on what would be some system that was a renewable, dedicated to renewables, or that's not clear to me?
Ms. Taylor.
Madam Chair, the point here would be we'd be more comfortable with that. We'd be more comfortable with other language. What we really are looking for in terms of things that aren't renewable that would support renewable electricity are things like storage demonstration projects like Xcel Energy has been doing out in Wilmer, things like communications, advanced communication system to manage renewable energy projects, things like load smoothing or power smoothing for variable power production, things like that that would be directly related to enhancing renewable electricity development. So while we'd be more comfortable with that language, we'd be more comfortable with other language. So we just would like to say we'd like to continue to talk about this and see if we could come to some kind of agreement. In the alternative, if in fact we're going to expand the use of the fund beyond renewable electricity, and that's what this does, we go into other interesting electricity innovative projects, if we're going to do that, then we would like to see stronger statutory support for the makeup of the advisory group. Now, I've got to say, I am a member of the advisory group now. I represent Fresh Energy on that advisory group. And I will say that anybody who wants to be on the advisory group should think carefully about it. It's a lot of work. And I will also say that as a member of the advisory group, what I have observed is extraordinarily good administration of the money that comes through the Xcel advisory board process. The reports that we get from these projects are detailed to the extent that I cannot understand them on the technical level. And so we're always trying to get the people who are reporting back to us to explain things in lay terms, and that sort of thing. But if you read those reports on the website, for the projects that have been done. They are detailed, and they're extraordinarily well done. The advisory group itself has worked on a consensus basis throughout the past. There aren't votes, for example, and that sort of thing. But these people do a lot of background work. So be careful when you're thinking about who to add to this advisory group. We need people who will work, and that's important to keep in mind. So just to say, we'd like to see this specifically for renewable electricity. If we're going to expand beyond renewable electricity types of projects, then we'd like to see stronger statutory support for the makeup of the board itself, so that we know that that board is going to provide a balance between the strong interests that the company will have in those other kinds of projects and the original purpose for the fund.
First off, Ms. Taylor, thank you for serving on the advisory board. That's really great that you do that. And I appreciate your advice on the renewable part of the change. I think it needs just a little more work if we can get that and make sure that everybody is comfortable with that, because that does change it just a little bit. And we do have some time with that. And Senator Hayden.
Oh, good. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I think that most of my questions were answered. I did just want to know, I didn't know who I saw Mr. Fuller make some comments, and so I was just trying to understand his role in this committee. I didn't know if he was our CA or is he a research staff.
Nonpartisan research.
We all want to know.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I wasn't being facetious. I just didn't know who he was. So I was just trying to
understand. He's the Senate counsel.
Oh, he's Senate counsel. Oh, okay. I just wanted to be sure I knew who he was for the record.
Yeah. Probably the only one that's been around to really see this whole thing develop a long time ago. So.
Why don't we have Fuller? Why don't you ask?
Okay. Thank you,
Ms.
Taylor.
Answer the question, Fuller.
Mr. Hinkle. And we are going to take a vote today on this. Mr. Hinkle?
Well, Madam Chair, while he's coming to the...
Sure. Senator McGuire.
So we're not going to entertain Ms. Taylor's suggestion about adding renewable to the amendment.
Senator McGuire, this does have to go to finance, so there is some room. I'm not comfortable with accepting that. I'm comfortable with the conversation continuing. I mean, we can take a vote on it, but I, as the author, I'm not comfortable with that yet, because we need to hear from the utilities and all the other proper people. So, Senator Howell.
Madam Chair, and I just, before Mr. Hinkle speaks, I just, you know, I know he's an advocate for solar, and I see that's one of the major renewable energies that isn't spelled out under Subdivision 2. You know, I just think that we're allocating, you know, through legislation here, some of this money. And I'm just thinking that, you know, solar is one of our major renewables. So I think it should be mentioned maybe, you know.
Senator
Vandegrift. I also agree, I think, with Senator Howe. I think it offers great potential and should be considered.
Well, I think the language actually does not limit it.
And that's correct.
And because if we start going down that road, then we have to start earmarking and making silos again. It makes me a little uncomfortable that way. And frankly, trust me, I mean, I just found out last weekend, Bob Wirtz in my district received the award for the nation from Secretary Chu for solar panels on schools. You don't think I'm excited about that? Do you know Bob Wirtz, Mr. Hinkle? It's a very, very exciting technology, but I'm just very uncomfortable with, again, singling out specific generation like that. And it just, you know, like I said, I would love it, but
Madam Chair,
it does not exclude it. So.
Thank you. I'm sorry, before we hear more testimony, Ms. Taylor referenced that she had submitted some testimony, and I don't know if I missed it or was it meant for the committee? I mean, I didn't see anything in my packet of Ms. Taylor's testimony.
I don't have, do we have that?
If we could get copies of that, that would be great.
Oh, maybe missed that in your packet then. It's a little disorganized here.
Can we maybe make copies for everyone about this?
Everybody should have them.
Everybody has them already?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Thank
you. Mr. Hinkle.
Thank you, Senator DeRozan, and members of the committee. Again, for the record, my name is Lynn Hinkle. Policy Director for the Minnesota Solar Energy Industry Association, representing the entire Minnesota solar value chain. I'm here today to support Senator Rosen's Senate File 2181 pertaining to the Renewable Development Fund. NCEA appreciates being heard in the development of this bill, and we look forward to working with the process to develop proposals as we have discussed with Senator Rosen and Excel. Before discussing that, I'd like to highlight language that we find consistent and aligned with our message as an industry. I don't have the bill right in front of me at this moment, but I've said this repeatedly to staff and members sitting around the table this afternoon that we're very impressed with the language that talks about increasing market penetration. We're very impressed by the language that talks about attracting and expanding the industries in the state. We think this is an enhancement of the RDF language that has great potential for the development of our industry in this state. We know that the market is well established in our state, and I've talked about this at previous hearings, and I'll be relatively brief, but one of the points that we make to folks a lot, and Senator Howe and others have heard me say this before, is that we have a robust but not well understood solar manufacturing supply chain in the state that, quite honestly, on a conservative basis, has well over 3,000 direct and indirect manufacturing jobs in the state. So this is a question for us of not establishing an industry, but helping to grow it and attract new investment, and we think that this bill is a step in that direction. As I indicated earlier, we believe there is a real opportunity to work with Excel and other key stakeholders in developing the RFP and strong proposals that aggregate solar energy projects from several schools and public jurisdictions. This turns a concern that we've had as MNCEA for resources from individual schools and other individual public entities into viable proposals that may be able to layer in not just more solar panels installed in schools or public buildings, but analysis of finance mechanisms, cost effectiveness, and job creation potential. And as I said, there's nothing really wrong with our getting more solar panels on public buildings and schools, but I think we can do a lot to enhance our understanding of how financing can be done more effectively, developing more cost-effective installations, and analyzing that as part of these aggregate proposals. I think there was a possibility even when we spoke earlier of solar on public buildings of allowing individual school districts and public entities to essentially attempt to compete on their own. We're excited about reaching out and developing aggregate proposals that we think are going to be very competitive within this process. We look forward to that next phase, and again, I'd like to thank you, Senator Rosen, and the committee for an opportunity to testify today, and certainly appreciate the comments from Senators Howe and Vandeveer, and I look forward to working with you and your constituents in aggregating this into or aggregating those schools and public buildings. I know Senator Brown has a number of projects. I suspect that's true of everyone sitting around the table. So the next phase will be working with you to put those proposals together and compete in developing compelling proposals before the advisory committee.
Mr. Hinkle, as you've been a pleasure to work with, too, and really appreciate our conversations. And we've had many in the office on this, and I think we both respect where we're coming from, and both are headed in the same direction. And so I appreciate your input and, sticking with us on this. I expect some great things in the area of solar. So any further questions? Mr. Hinkle, for the bill. Thank you, Mr. Hinkle. Did you have a
Madam Chair, to come to a vote, I'd like to request a roll call.
Sure. Roll call has been requested. Roll call will be given. Anybody else like to testify? Okay, with that, I move that Senate File 2181 as amended be recommended to pass. A roll call has been requested. The chair votes yes.
Why does it have to go to finance?
We referred to finance, right? Oh,
okay. And we referred to finance. Yes, thank you.
Senator Benson.
Yes.
Senator Brown.
Yes.
Senator Dibble.
No.
Senator Hayden.
No.
Senator Howell.
Yes.
Senator Jungbauer.
Yes.
Senator Koch.
Yes.
Senator Magnus.
Yes.
Senator McGuire.
No.
Senator Metzen.
Yes.
Senator Sparks.
Yes.
Senator Vandeveer.
Yes.
There being 10 ayes and 3 noes, the motion prevails. The bill passes. Thank you very much, members. Appreciate your indulgence on this bill, very important bill. Next Tuesday, we have Senator Senjum's Rule 47 bill, and Senator Buck has a bill up on utility disconnect notice requirements. Thank you. The meeting is adjourned.